Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Professor Dina Weibel about spirituality, space travel, and pilgrimage. A little bit about Professor Weibel. She's a cultural anthropologist right here at Grand Valley State University, whose work focuses primarily on religion, especially the topics of pilgrimage and sacred space. Her main fieldwork takes place in France at pilgrimage sites venerating the Virgin Mary. Other research interests include religious cognition and sacred objects, and the role of anthropology and her own family in the ethnological displays of Philippine tribal peoples at fairs and carnivals in the 1900s. She is an advising faculty member for the Grand Valley State University Religious Studies Program and also a board member right here at the Interfaith Dialogue Association. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Dina Weibel. Hi, Dina.
Hi, Fred.
Thanks for joining us again.
Sure.
So last week we covered various aspects of space travel, spirituality. Let's talk about spirituality and spirituality, space travel, specifically as pilgrimage. Because pilgrimage is really your thing. You've done a lot of work on it. What's the corollary? How do you see space travel as pilgrimage?
We've only got a half hour, right? First of all, if I want to define pilgrimage first, it is travel to a place that's considered sacred for religious purposes. And so a lot of things that we consider pilgrimage, it's very broad. So if I'm talking about the seekers of religious freedom who left England and settled in the American colonies, we'd call that pilgrimage because they were seeking religious freedom. Their travel was motivated by religion. Obviously, some religions in the world are strongly associated with pilgrimage. So Muslims are required by the tenets of Islam to go to Mecca at least once in their life if they can afford it and if their health will allow it. Pilgrimage is really important in Hinduism. Christians, especially Catholics, will go on pilgrimage, but the Holy Land is very important for Protestants as well. You'll have a lot of Protestant trips to the Holy Land. Going to Jerusalem is an important pilgrimage for Jews. And Buddhists have amazing pilgrimages and different sites and different types of Buddhism. But there are also secular pilgrimages. And so if you're a group of motorcycle guys who get on your bikes and go to the Vietnam Memorial, you're going to a sacred place for spiritual reasons. There's something about that that's meaningful to you. So pilgrimage is a very wide descriptor. And one thing that I've noticed studying space travel is that a lot of the things that are done in pilgrimage are also done in space travel. And one way to think about this is to think about objects. Religious objects are really important in pilgrimage. And I've noticed there are three major categories. If you go on pilgrimage, often you will bring something back with you. And if you bring that thing back with you, it almost like holds the essence of the pilgrimage with it. So if I go to Lourdes in France and there's water there that is purported to have healing powers, I might bring back containers of water for my family members. And that is like taking the essence of Lourdes back with you. And people do that with the Zamzam water in Mecca and also with water from the Ganges. That water sort of retains that essence. A second category of object is what anthropologists call an ex voto. It means after the vow. It is an object that you leave at a site to show that you made that pilgrimage. And I see that a lot in Catholic pilgrimage where people will leave photographs of their loved ones, or in the American Southwest, milagros, which are little tin or aluminum representations of the human body. So if my grandfather is having a heart problem, I might leave a little milagro of a heart at a pilgrimage site, say in Chimayo in New Mexico, for instance, leaving these objects behind to show that you've been there, that the vow has been completed. The third type is one that I've noticed a lot in my research that less has been written about, which is objects that are transformed. So you see this a lot in neo-pagan pilgrimage, for instance, where somebody might go to Walsingham or Stonehenge, and bring a favorite piece of jewelry with them and take it there so that it can sort of be in the place and be transformed in some way and then be brought back. And then that object contains some special reverence. It has a memory associated with it, or in some language that's used religiously, energy associated with it. Often there's a discussion of charging jewelry or charging religious figurines in sacred places. What I've noticed with going to the moon, for instance, which is the only place we've been that's not a man-made place, you know, is that those same three things happen. So moon rocks are the only thing we've brought back from the moon, but a lot of people will respond with great reverence to moon rocks. I had an opportunity a couple years ago to have somebody I knew check out moon rocks from NASA, brought them to a class and passed them around. And for some of the students, that was just very close to a religious experience, if not on the border of a religious experience. My own wedding ring has a little chip of lunar meteorite in it.
Really?
Yeah, and Martian meteorite too. So a little piece of the moon and a little piece of Mars. You can get meteorites because they land on Earth, so it's not like you have to go and get them, but they still kind of have that essence of the planet. So bringing stuff back from the moon. Second category, leaving stuff on the moon. We left a lot of stuff that was just junk, you know, like, oh, we need to get rid of these bags of human waste or whatever. But a lot of things that were left there were left with great significance. So one of the lunar rovers has a red Bible sitting on it. The Bible's probably not red anymore with all that exposure to sunlight, but it's still there. It hasn't been disturbed. A lot of the astronauts who went to the moon left photos of their family, which is exactly what I see on pilgrimage. The idea that I'm here, I made it, I'm leaving this as a marker that I'm here. There was a very small statue known as the Fallen Astronaut, which was left, I believe, without NASA's permission on the moon to sort of mark the people who had died as part of the space race, both astronauts and cosmonauts, and to sort of honor them with leaving something for them on the moon. And not to give spoilers, but if anybody has seen the movie First Man, the Ryan Gosling biopic about Neil Armstrong, there's a scene where something is left on the moon that's clear it's supposed to have a strong spiritual association. The third category is the most interesting, I find, taking things to the moon or taking things to space and bringing them back. There's a whole category of objects you can buy on eBay that are space-flown objects.
And
Yes, and these objects are things that have been into space and brought back, and they carry more value than anything. You might have an amazing piece of NASA, an artifact from NASA that was important to the Apollo program, but if that has been in space, that is something that stays with it. And astronauts have frequently been asked to bring things into space, even during the Apollo program. Jewelry from their wives and different objects for people, religious objects into space. And those objects remain important. Like one example, if I can, Buzz Aldrin famously took communion on the moon soon after the Eagle landed on the moon. So there was this sort of moment of silence. And during that moment of silence, Aldrin, who was a Presbyterian, went to Webster Church in outside of Houston. He had this little chalice, and he also had some communion wine that his pastor had sent with him. And he poured the wine in from a very small kind of envelope into this chalice and actually took communion on the moon. That chalice is on display at the Webster Church now. And so it's a famous historical thing because it was, you know, the first, it's a lot of things, but part of what its allure is that it's been on the moon. So it is a communion chalice that was, first of all, the first food ever consumed on the moon was communion. And this chalice was there and it was part of that. So this maintains almost relic-like status. And because of those three categories and because of the amount of religious activity that has been associated, especially with the moon landings, I definitely think it can be understood as a type of pilgrimage, going to the moon.
I can easily see that, certainly. One of the reasons that you and I are talking right now is because we are at the time of the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
Yes.
And I know that you have done a significant amount of research into the Apollo program and the spiritual backdrop of the astronauts and all of that. Just could you just address that in general?
Oh, absolutely. One of the important things to keep in mind was, because our rivals in the race to the moon were the Soviets, and they were an officially atheistic state, part of what defined America vis-a-vis the Soviets was the religiousness of America. This was a God-fearing country. We weren't godless like the quote-unquote commies. And so it was this battle between those who were ordained by God and those who didn't believe in God. And that was a huge motivating factor for the American space program. I won't say it motivated everyone, but I have seen documents where NASA got the religious backgrounds of every one of the astronauts, probably for last rites type purposes. And the vast majority of them were Christian, with just a couple no preferences sprinkled here and there. And because of that, it became a success for, I actually recently interviewed a tech who worked on Apollo 11, and he straight out believes that we won the moon race because God was on our side. And so he was there at the time. He was very young. But that idea that we were doing something ordained by God and God was on our side, getting us to the moon ahead of our enemies who didn't believe in God, was a very strong kind of narrative structure at the time. Apollo 8 was the first mission that actually went to the moon, even though they didn't do a landing. They orbited the moon and came back. And the three men on board Apollo 11, I'm not going to go through their names because it's escaping my mind right now, although I can see all their faces. They wanted to mark the occasion with something special. And so it was Christmas Eve, 1968, and they read from the book of Genesis describing the creation of the earth while looking at the earth from outside. And this was something that was tremendously moving to a lot of people. Obviously, Genesis is important in a lot of religions, not just Christianity, obviously Judaism, but Islam as well. And it was meant to be a strong recognition and expression of gratitude that they had been able to do this. There was blowback. You might know that Madeleine Murray O'Hare of American Atheists actually sued NASA over it. And after that, NASA did try to sort of tamp down overt expressions of religion because of the issue of the separation of church and state. But that didn't stop the astronauts themselves from being religious. Quite a few astronauts had what can be described as conversion experiences. Several of them wrote about them famously. Jim Irwin is a really good example. He was on Apollo 15. He claims that it strengthened his faith. After he left NASA, he got very involved in religion. I believe his organization was called Higher Calling, something like that. And he looked for Noah's Ark, spent quite a lot of time in the mountains of Turkey looking for evidence of Noah's Ark.
Did he find it?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Can I just interrupt briefly to remind people that you're listening to WGVU? The program is Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella, and Professor Dina Weibel from here at Grand Valley State University is our guest, and we're talking about spirituality, pilgrimage, and space travel. So continue. Let's talk about Mr. Mitchell.
Ah, Edgar Mitchell. Edgar Mitchell was an interesting case. I have interviewed one of the Apollo astronauts who knew him. Edgar Mitchell unfortunately passed just a year or so ago. But he was a unique individual. And one of the things that he did while he was on his mission was conduct experiments involving ESP while he was in space. So he had those cards, you know, with the wavy lines or the star or the other symbols on them, and was trying to do sort of psychic readings with somebody else who I believe was in the San Francisco area at the time.
I'm sorry, he just assumed that, or guessed maybe because he's in space, that his powers would be amplified?
Something like that.
Okay.
I think it was just, when else are you going to get the opportunity to try it?
Right.
But he had a very strong spiritual moment traveling in space where he felt connected to the universe in a way that he had never felt before. He describes it in some of his writings. He's got a couple books out. And it was like this sense that the entire universe was one thing, that he was part of the universe, that everything was connected to each other, and that he was being given this information from the universe while he was out there. And he founded something afterwards called the Institute of Noetic Sciences. So the idea being that you can get knowledge from different sources. One source he thought was empirical knowledge, right? So you can do research, you can look at something, you can use your senses. But he felt also that knowledge that was true knowledge could come to you. And that what had happened to him while he was in space was an example of that knowledge that just came to you, which he called noesis. And so the Institute of Noetic Sciences was really to explore that kind of knowledge that's obtained through non-empirical methods. Very interesting person. I would have loved to have interviewed him. I never got the opportunity.
Now, in your article, you refer to that experience as samadhi.
Are you quoting it?
That's his term.
That's his term.
Now that is, I know it's a Hindu term. It also may be a Buddhist term. And I'm just I'm curious. Did he convert to one of those Eastern religions?
I don't believe so, but I do believe they were a strong influence. I think this was, as I'm sure you know, late 60s, early 70s. There was a very strong influence mm-hmm. of Eastern religions in the United States at this time. And we see things in other religions, for instance, in Wicca and New Age, karma has become a term that's a very sure. typical kind of thing. So there's a lot of borrowing during that time period. My guess is that when he described it, he probably had interactions with religious leaders from Hinduism who tried to help him understand it in terms that made sense.
Do we know what his proclivity was prior to liftoff?
I don't think he was particularly religious.
Okay.
I think he was very curious about what the human mind was capable of. But these were sort of strong driving interests that I think were separate from any traditional religious upbringing.
And you spoke to Tom Calvin.
Tom Calvin is a pseudonym for an astronaut who was
right.
not in space during the Apollo program, but active during the Apollo program on the ground.
And what was his reaction when you...
the astronaut I refer to as Tom Calvin, he's a self-described evangelical. And when I asked him about Edgar Mitchell's experience in space, he said something like, well, he thought he felt something. It was very dismissive, I will say. But that makes sense because that kind of thing is not part of his religious tradition.
Right. And speaking of that, you've spoken to and did research on various viewpoints from the evangelical stance, mm-hmm. right? And so some people, am I correct in reading that some people were actually opposed to space travel coming from that background?
Certainly not among the astronauts, but there...
No, not the astronauts.
Right,
no.
But there's a political scientist I know at the University of Dayton, Joshua Ambrosius, and he does a lot of heavy work with data and statistics and numbers, and he's pulled some of the numbers from Pew studies, and he's very interested in the fact that of the different religious groups that they surveyed about space travel, evangelical Christians tended to be the least supportive. And part of the reason for that is if you believe is that Jesus is coming in the near future, there's no real reason to go into space. It's not a priority. On the other hand, other religions are much more willing to assume there's a future that needs to happen and to be interested in moving forward into that future. That said, a lot of there are evangelical astronauts for sure. And so these are people who do think that it's worthwhile to travel into space. So it's not, we can't paint an entire group with one brush.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. what do you see happening in the near future with the astronauts who are coming up now? I say this because there seems to be a diminishment of religious adherence.
Well, interestingly, and I can't guarantee that these folks are going to end up in the astronaut program, but there's definitely interest in becoming an astronaut among some very religious people. So last week I mentioned that I'd been to the NASA Human Research Investigators Program workshop in Galveston, Texas. And I did interviews with two young women there who both want to become astronauts or planning to apply. Both of them are working on their PhDs. One was a very devout Muslim. She covered, and she was there at the conference in hijab. And she very strongly had, this was her dream, was to be an astronaut. And she was telling me about verses, surahs in the Quran that she interpreted as encouraging humans to go into space. We talked about the modesty afforded by spacesuits and how, you know, you can't really tell anything. So she felt that a spacesuit was good. I said, well, what about hijab? Would you be in space covered? She said she couldn't see why she boxes well in hijab. Mm. So she, I think her profile, if she applies to NASA, she's going to be a very interesting candidate. Another young woman I spoke to was studying a lot of sort of evolutionary human adaptation kind of things. And she was a very devout Hindu from a Brahmanic tradition, strong Vedantic background. And so her understanding of religion was something very akin to science. And there was a strong overlap. And she talked with me about how her family members were required through history to be both scientists as Brahmins and do rituals and to combine religion and science in a way that was totally natural to her. And so for her, she felt that it was her dharma to go into space. That was the term she used. And so when I see examples of very religious young people who are planning to apply to the astronaut program, who want their whole life to be about this, but bring their religion in as just a matter of course, I don't think that it's really going anywhere. I think when people work for NASA, it's very important to present yourself in a certain way. And if there are topics that might be controversial, to avoid those topics. But talking to people pre-NASA and retired astronauts, there's a lot of religiosity that's there. It's just not necessarily overt while they are astronauts.
I'm not sure I understand what you say. Certain topics shouldn't be brought up.
Well, for instance, if a contemporary astronaut who was not retired were to make some statement about such or such religion being true or such religion being false, that might be something that would bring negative attention to NASA. So there's this need to make sure that you're, you know, the one contemporary astronaut, like current astronaut I interviewed, wouldn't talk to me about religion at all. And this person instead was talking about the importance of being a team player and a lot of information that was the kind of thing you would find in NASA publicity materials. So not straying from the official focus.
And by not talking about religion, you didn't get the impression that this person was not necessarily religious? Or
no, just that that person felt that they were not willing to risk a future flight on saying something that might be taken out of context that might be controversial.
I understand. Last week we talked a little bit about rituals and the importance of them. And oftentimes we think of rituals as outside of science, but in what I've read of yours, there actually can be scientifically, I'll use the word proven, benefit of ritual, regardless of the religion or lack thereof religion, just the performing them by themselves?
Certainly there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there are health benefits from belonging to a religious community. Religious rituals it's very clear, reduce stress in a lot of cases. They can help with situations like coping. One of the interesting things is that people who are regular attendees of religious services have better health outcomes, and they think that it's in part because you have a weekly gathering where people know if you're not feeling well, people see if you don't show up. So it's that community created by the religious background. But once again, I cannot rule out that there isn't a benefit from religiosity in performing rituals. That is something that science has not yet discovered.
We understand. I want to end the same way we did last week, which is encouraging people who would like to learn more about your research, which, I'm biased. You're a longtime colleague, and I love your work, but it is very readable.
Thank you.
Uneducated, including myself, if somebody does want to get a hold of this, what is that website you gave us last week?
There is a website where you can get a lot of interesting stuff called academia.edu. It is a site where you can put in a researcher's name or a topic, and it's a place where people who are in the academic fields can upload articles and also download articles. You don't have to be a member to be able to have access to people's information there. And I have several articles on my page. So if they type in my name, they should be able to find it.
Wonderful. And that's Deana, D-E-A-N-A, and Weibel is W-E-I-B-E-L. And I also mentioned last week that if you are driving and you just can't retain all this information, very easily go to our website, interfaithdialogueassociation.org, and email us from there, and we'll make sure that you get what you're looking for. Deana, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly, last week as well. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Deana Weibel has been our guest today. Please join us again next week right here on Common Threads.